We're still going through the paper proposals. They're all quite good, and you should sooner or later be getting an email from somebody commenting upon them in some way. Some of you may already have gotten such an email, and you may even get more as three of us engage in a reply to all dialogue about your proposal in front of you. Sit tight, you haven't got one, and if you have, hopefully you'll find it useful. And maybe I'll be seeing lots of you join this week and next as office hours roll down. So, where were we left? End of yesterday with our many guests. Here's one brief thing of where we are. We were talking about privacy. We didn't say we were talking about privacy, but as you may have gathered, in fact, out of today's meetings, we were in fact talking about privacy. And the element of privacy we were working the most, of course, was identity, right? As long as we're talking about John and Jane Doe, it's whether or not you can shield your identity as you engage in particular conversations to lots and lots of people uniquely enabled by the development of the internet. And somehow there's this link between your identity and your speech. You want to say certain things. It used to be it was hard not to be identified in some way as you did. Indeed, even if you were Mrs. McIntyre, you're walking around out there handing out leaflets, if what you said was truly criminal, perhaps there was an obscene picture on that leaflet, not protected by the First Amendment, subject to felony charges, particularly if you're dancing back and forth over a state line or you're in four corners and really triggering multiple felonies as you go around in a circle. In that instance, they still have the person. They know who it was, who did it, you've got fingerprints, they can try to ID you. On the net, it can be a little bit more difficult, depending on the technology deployed on either side, as to whether the somewhat man of few words, Terry Lenzner, can track you down, or whether you can get the better of him as you try to do your cyber leafleting. And of course, we also noticed a shift, certainly yesterday's conversation, but wasn't so much the government interested in finding out how good you were for its own purposes, but rather third parties. But often those third parties were turning to the government, and indeed, when we talk about First Amendment challenges raised to subpoenas being issued by courts, underlying that is the assumption that we've got a state action required for a typical First Amendment challenge. For those of you who have not taken common law, please take common law, I urge you. I don't know if you've hit the state action doctrine yet, but I commend it to you. It's something worth learning about. But in that action, we still have state action because, after all, it's the government that holds you in contempt and issues a penalty if you don't listen to the government and obey that subpoena. Now, the tension between identity and speech is one of, I've got a First Amendment interest in anonymous speech, just the kind that's vindicated in the McIntyre case, because sometimes I may not say certain things if it can be traced back to me. And indeed, an employee talking about an employer may be a classic case. Think about whistleblower sorts of people who want to say certain things, but if it can be found out who they are, they're not granted some other kind of protection. Like the sui generis whistleblower protections that we have in certain instances, then you may find certain speech simply not happening. And we may decide societally that's a bad thing. Now, of course, speech isn't the only thing that happens on the net. There's also different forms of action. You can do things through the net, whether it's data packets that are affecting you doing it or not. Certainly some things like a threatening email to somebody are deemed not only speech, but a form of action. The conveyance of a threat to somebody is something you're doing and then typically won't get First Amendment protection because it's not merely speech, it's actually a criminal act. And of course, it's not too big a step from action to transaction, since more and more of the stuff happening on the net is commercial transactions between people or between merchants and people. You might question to what extent your identity itself can be tied to the transaction and do this for other purposes later on. But at least for yesterday's class, we dwelt on pretty much the top circle of that unicolored traffic light, the speech thing. And of course, the flip side, I've already talked about the chilling effect we may have if the identity is too readily tied into the person. That's sort of the Paul Levy's argument. The other side of it is accountability. If you are permitted to say something and there's no way of knowing who you are when you do it, then there's no way of making pay if, in fact, what you said was actionable. In a world in which free speech was absolute, you wouldn't really run into this problem. But free speech, of course, is far from absolute. Not only do we have obscenity, as I mentioned, or threats, which is deemed an action, not speech, but there are defamation and libel, statements about the world that you can make that indeed are only words, but are deemed to be something for which maybe you can't go to jail. Indeed, maybe it would be hard to get prior restraint. You are ordered not to utter the following words, but rather, you can utter the words, it's just you're going to have to have a fat wallet because we're going to come after you and make you pay damages for having done so. And of course, it's harder to go after people if you don't know who they are. So we thought of is this accountability line in the middle. I wonder if there are comments or questions coming out of yesterday's discussion, which by all rights is a 2-hour discussion, and we ended it at the hour and a half mark. So there's certainly more to be said. Is there any lingering thoughts or comments or questions from kind of battle we witnessed at some point? I thought Paul and Bruce were going to come to blows, but I'm delighted they shared taxis together, I think, to the airport. Yeah, Amanda escorted them to Harvard Square, so it kept them a healthy distance from each other. And it worked out just fine. Yeah?
So the question I actually had...
Can I try the mic, I think?
I know, that's
why
I lost the floor yesterday. I know, Aaron. The question I had yesterday, which I did have the opportunity to ask one of the gentlemen about later, but I still like hear what you would say, was I was trying to understand that our line politically protected cyber speech and cybersphere, and I'm specifically thinking of a case like Terminix, where like, somebody sets up a website, Valley sucks, or whatever.
Right.
And I understand that maybe they can't do meta tags because maybe it's not a commercial site trying to actually sell a product like Valley or Terminix. Where did they get in trouble under trademark for using the name, the trademark holder's name, in order to draw attention to the political message that they want to make?
Yeah, they got into that whole riff under the Lanham Act back and forth. And yeah, something we were in trademark zone. Even Bruce conceded that you need some commercial hook for some of the Lanham Act protections against somebody using your goodwill and trademark. And using it, meaning that somebody else in the world who knows of your trademark, has done a great effort to plaster it on ads for the Super Bowl, types into a search engine, it comes up with a competitor's site. And even though the competitor says, by the way, please don't confuse us with the real thing, we are the better thing than the real thing, that could be potentially a Lanham Act. Without knowledge or consent of Mr. Henley, you obtained the name DonHenley.com. Are you use it to operate a website. Your conduct infringes our client's rights in numerous ways, including false association and false designation, in violation of 15 U.S.C. 1125, Lanham Act, requiring dilution, rights duplicity, blah, blah, blah. And it's not a complete recitation of our client's rights. We reserve the right to assert other recorded claims in connection with your actions. We understand that Donald Henley may also be your personal name. However, that does not give you the right to use that name in a way that is likely to confuse the public in order to preclude your client from exercising his trademark rights in connection with the domain name. Anyway, Matt Phelps. We interviewed Matt Phelps the past couple weeks. Great interview question to ask him about this case, but I recommend you look at the site more. So anyway, a lot of this stuff, as Paul said, we don't have a whole lot of written opinions on it. And we get one from either a state or a federal district court, typically not, you know, a great moment. So suddenly everybody seizes upon it as, now it's been decided by the world the way it goes. So to me, most of this stuff is wide open. An artifact of the fact that it's only the past 5 years that, you know, tech sergeant Don Henley has been able to attract thousands of people to his testimony because of the association with Don Henley, or because his site is so persuasive in general society. Other questions or comments from yesterday. My sense of where we left it, just as a doctrinal matter, is that it's a big mess. Judges don't quite know how to deal with it. They're not used to hearing First Amendment arguments in litigation of this sort. And suddenly a First Amendment argument pops up, and you have very confused judges trying to deal with it. And we got into the question of, well, the timing of it. Is there some way we can litigate parts of the merits of the claim? Whether under this SLAPP statute, an extra critical look at the pleadings to see if there's really something there or not. And if there isn't, don't allow John Doe to be identified if indeed the third party being served can, like an ISP, can identify the John Doe. But then there was, of course, disagreement as to how far we should go. I was actually surprised to hear Bruce Fishman say that he wouldn't act on behalf of a client who simply wanted to learn the identity of an employee to use perfectly legal mechanisms to initiate a case and then drop it. But then he gave an ambiguous story about that visit to the wife of the employee that I wasn't sure exactly how it fit in, but it was quite interesting. And then on the ACLU or the public citizen side of things, we've got this idea we can litigate as much as we can. If truth is in fact a valid defense to a claim of libel, then we can litigate truth of the matter without having to identify the accuser, the person, in this case, the defendant. On the other hand, if it's something like an actual malice standard under libel law, where the state of mind of the defendant is relevant, did you know or should you have known, but did you know that what you were writing was false, clearly you need a chance to depose the witness and get his or her demeanor, etc., trying to put them behind it, you know, Tony the Tiger scrim and remain known during that position. Seems not very useful. You could also imagine saying, we'll tell you who the person is if you agree not to engage in, say, firing the person for having found out who they are, instead stick merely to the defamation action. I don't think anybody suggests that in particular. But it was a question of how much you could get forward in litigation without having to identify. Now, also, the jurisdictional point seems interesting to me. If somebody can plead, you have no personal jurisdiction over me, I don't live in Florida, even though you don't know who I am, that seems thing to do. But again, third-party trusted systems, the following trusted party can certify that, in fact, I have provided credential that shows I'm a resident of Pennsylvania. And you still don't know who I am. Maybe the third party does. But that third party at least is willing to vouch for a narrow question of jurisdiction that I don't live there. Boom. And maybe you'd say, jurisdiction problem solved. And then back again, you had Bruce's lament that, in a way, it lets the accuser, which is to say the defendant, the person generating this controversial speech, get a lot of digs in and not have to pay reputationally for it or really risk anything unless he or she loses this kind of advice to the apple in a sense. So it leaves it in a fairly uncertain position and provides actually a nice segue to what we want to talk about today, which is sort of other elements of privacy, starting with workplace privacy. And that was our rotisserie question of the week. Last year we did this class, and it was smaller, but it also had some MIT students who quite well seasoned the class, and as a block tended to vote together, sort of like the old Cold War, but now they're gone, and the wall is down, and it's just us. So as the sole remaining superpower in Austin, we tended to think somewhat similarly about this. Here's a sampling of some of the answers we got. John Barry, you here? officer was saying, law firm has every right to establish surveillance of every email, just as it can search the desk of narcotics. And why don't the employees just keep their work and personal email separate? Of course, that is exactly the firm's act as it should. That's the wonderful kind of, on the other hand, I might be wrong, kind of defensive maneuver. So employees should keep work and personal email separate. By that, we mean you shouldn't even be sending a personal email during an hour in which you are at work. Is that right? Is that what you meant by it?
No, that's a mischaracterization.
You just meant that. Tell me what you did.
What I mean is, I don't think that an employee should use an employer's mail server to send a personal email if they don't want that email to be surveilled.
And is this a branding issue?
It's partially a branding issue. I think that's a very serious concern, especially when you're dealing with domain names that are associated with fairly well-known corporations. In addition, I think it's an issue that when you work for a company, they provide you with an email address. You know, you're essentially on their turf in that way. My point isn't that when you're at work, you should be sending private personal emails. Quite the contrary. I think if you've got a shell account open in an SSH window or telnet window sitting on your desktop, send all the personal email you want, spend 8 hours a day doing it. And, you know, eventually you'll get fired, but, you know, I don't think the employer should surveil.
So as long as it's Yahoo.com or Hotmail or something, that's fine, Morgan. And in fact, the employer, much like the carnivore agent, who may be monitoring what you're doing on the employee server, as soon as they detect that you connect to Hotmail, they should drop the headphones, let you do your thing, and just see you at the end. It produces absolutely no worry, and as a result, you'll be fired.
Yeah, more or less. I think that there's certainly ways where an employee can protect themselves in that respect. And I just kind of take this position based on my previous experience. Working at a technology company, everyone that I've worked with, at least within the IT department, had an external email, encrypted their email, or had shell caps along those lines.
Yeah.
We basically didn't feel like the network admin should be sniffing packets.
Right.
I mean, that's a little bit more than you expect in terms of privacy intrusions.
Right.
Sniffing what packets are going to Hotmail or this or that or whatever. But in terms of actually sitting down at your copy of Microsoft Outlook that's connected to the company mail server and you're sending it to the company domain, I don't know how much expectation of privacy there really is there.
Yeah. Is anybody aware of a Harvard policy on the use of domain name sending in, say, law.harvard.edu? Since there's actually a good Harvard name out there that you're using. Oh, TJ Twain, you may have some. That's very
They're not fond of it, actually.
They're not
too fond of it, actually. Though, you'd be surprised because students can, within their rooms on their own Students can, within their own rooms on their own network, set up a server, which will then end in .law.harvard.edu. You can set up Zitrain, .law.harvard.edu.
Yeah, apparently I have. One of the computers in my office is identified as that, which ruins it for most of the serving in my business.
Well, that might not be a good idea. But if you were to want to set up your own domain name independent of .law.harvard.edu, as soon as you start going near law or Harvard or HLS or any sort of other, anything close to that, they take issue. And it is written out in the provost policy from back in April last year.
Yeah, the end still has a dry on it, but it's
no
there. Yeah. Anybody have helped frame that policy?
Pardon?
I said, anybody have helped frame that policy?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Karen, maybe you're over here. Oh, yeah, there you are. You're still over there. Oh, no. You seem like the price is right. You should be happy. So feel free to accuse me of being a staunch. Karen, you are a staunch supporter of the First Amendment. Let me just make that clear. The firm is acting well out of its rights in this case, even if the email was sent from a firm email account on a firm supplied computer through the firm's email system. And it may not be the most professional thing to do when you write an email saying you hate the work you're doing, but your freedom to express your opinion about your own job, the one individual who you know and contact personally should be retained. So how do you frame that against John's claim?
Well, I was also looking at it specifically the fact that you were fired as a result of this, and not just whether or not the firm should be reading your emails. I thought the firing was just a bit extreme. for the conduct. But I really have a hard time accepting that any personal emails I send, whether or not I'm using the property of someone else, if I'm sending it to my own account to a personal friend, and that's the only person who should be reading it, who it really pertains to, I don't think that should be anyone else's concern.
And when you were you an associate? You haven't been affirmed yet, anyway. So somebody who has been affirmed, did you write your emails as if your boss was reading each and every one? Hum if you did. Okay. Hum if you did not. All right. Might be the same people humming. But yeah, Eric.
So since we've already said that this is like Oprah, I just feel compelled to share. This actually happened to me in my first job out of college in 1991.
Uh-huh.
I was fired because this very small music company that I worked for about 3 months was secretly reading emails between me and my supervisor, and my supervisor was complaining about the company to me, and I was receiving all the mails.
So you both got canned?
He was leaving, was the brilliant part. He was complaining because he was already leaving. I got canned because I was considered, I had been tainted by his bad news.
Yeah.
But the thing was, this was pretty extraordinary at the time. 1991, Congress hadn't said anything about who owns the email, who owns the lines, and who has the money. It was just a de novo kind of an issue.
Yeah.
And I was shattered, and I felt violated, and it was awful.
So what was your view on the history question?
My view was that it's not a good idea that I would pass. It was so personal, I just thought I would rather tell everyone in person. But I just wrote this example in because my view now is different from my view then. Because then there was no context in which this happened. I was shocked, I felt violated, it wasn't fair, I was the only one complaining, etc., etc. Then there was no common law, so to speak, about there was no other information to inform my expectations about having engaged in email work.
Yeah.
And this was intro work. Now, you know, I tend to side with Taryn in terms of my sensibilities towards personal and freedom of expression, but it's a different situation when there are employers who, for example, warrant their employees that be reserved for. When I worked at the State Department this summer, every time you log on the computer, the very first thing you say
is, warning, the Russians are reading.
Then every single thing you write down, we're going to be reading.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was told we were allowed to do personal emails, and I did them, but I was aware that every single thing I wrote down. And it's a different issue, I think, depending on the state of, I guess, the expectations you bring to the
application. Yeah, the Bureau of Diplomatic Security has hired a number of new email leaders that sort of sit in the email all day. Not theirs, yours. Yeah.
Can I ask a question just about how this works in the non-cyber context? So if you are at work, you take the company's stationery, write a letter on it, and you take the company's envelope and you use their, you know, postage meter, put the stamp on it,
yeah.
And then you stick it in the company mailbox. Do they have the right to open the letter before it reaches U.S. Postal Mail?
Does anybody want to opine on that subject? I have no really idea. It's a wonderful question. I don't know. My guess is that, well, I wouldn't even guess, right? It's not something you can derive from first principles. There may be a case on it. Mark?
I saw something somewhere saying that telemarketing companies were allowed to monitor employees' phone calls for the purpose of quality control or whatever, but that as soon as they determined that a certain phone call was personal, they were supposed to stop listening.
Calls have to be monitored with quality but not content. So you're speaking up.
So I don't know how that
telephones works, have a whole additional layer of regulation around them. That's just a new technology. Not so anymore, but they have some sui generis restrictions. I mean, if you're an employer and you're trying to figure out, there are a number of websites out there reporting to advise you, you're trying to figure out just how much surveillance you can do in an area of pretty much fraught with freedom for you, pretty much do what you like, whether you notify or not. Phone is the one sensitive area where you are supposed to either have a mean tone, you know, to notify when you, not just that you may listen to a call, but that you actually are listening.
How does that relate to all of the
emails? How is it that you... Well, emails are not covered.
something,
it's
right.
Totally different than...
I think it was Sean who was Superman, right? You write about this? Somebody wrote about ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and the way in which all things about consent don't really come into play because the employer is the owner of the facility as far as the act is concerned. So the employer consents to read your mail, and that's all it takes. Let me just get some people in the back end. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like the issue should be, we should be thinking about this more from the perspective of governance and the perspective of the corporation and what kind of tone they want to set. Even though this may be within their abilities, I think that the real thing you want to think about is, what sort of environment you want to create for the people working at the firm. And I think you create a very certain environment, a very specific environment, when you say, I'm going to read all your emails. And when that, it seems to me there's possibilities. A, it's explicitly known at the outset, in which case, I come into a firm and like, they're going to read all my emails. That's a little bizarre. I mean, what do I do about communicating with people? Because nobody works 60 minutes of every hour of every day when they're at work, at least not that I know of. I mean, maybe you're supposed
people
to
track it sometimes.
It just doesn't seem that people don't take little breaks throughout the day. I think that's actually healthy and a good thing for the environment. That seems to be, so that first case seems to be one that I would find troubling. The second case is where it's not explicitly known, and then the next thing you know is, somebody gets fired.
Right.
And then you find out it's because they didn't read an email, and then the reaction then is, oh my God, Big Brother is watching, even though it's not the Big Brother of the government, but it's still this Big Brother feeling. And then the third case is when, you don't control at all. And I think this idea of trust is probably one that would foster the best environment for the company.
Right. But interestingly, this gets this question of, what ought the right-thinking firm to do, not just right as in morally outstanding, but right as in profit maximizing. You want employees that aren't terrified of you or aren't the ones willing to live in a panoptimal environment. But one possible outcome of that theory is we think about, all right, should there be some policy implication to this possible behavior, is, well, take care of itself. The market will actually figure it out. Firms that have paranoid leaders that fire people for no reason or that read through mail will typically be less successful than other firms, or they'll have bargaining go on. If the union thinks it's really important that their mail not be read, that'll be their top demand, and maybe they'll get paid 1% less, but the market could fix that just as it could fix any number of other working conditions decisions in their contractual relationship. That's one possible conclusion to draw from your line of thinking. Is there a comment here yet?
I also, of course, that's from a sort of company letterhead point of view, and I think a company would be pretty pissed off if it was to find out that you sent a letter on the company's head page, which is basically from the company, because you as an employee of the company, basically the company saying George Mountains.
Yeah.
So basically it's the company saying the company's crap to someone who wants to employ it. And the company would be quite angry enough. I see the a company's email address as being essentially very similar to what people say, or it's analogous to the company's letterhead in a piece of paper.
So are you with John Barry on the idea that so long as you then just use Hotpants 15 and Yahoo from your desk, you're fine?
Then I think maybe it's an issue. I think the issue is because it's the company's email address rather than your own.
I also think that, getting back to the letterhead issue, I have no idea what the issue, whether you can intercept a letter written on letterhead. But it does seem clear to me that if you did write something on letterhead, the company would have some kind of ability to penalize you somehow, if they find out later.
Well, it could be an agency problem, misrepresenting the company.
Misrepresentation, so. But I'm not sure that you have the same expectations with email, that people interpret email to be the same representation of the company. If you get a message from someone at handleofdoor.com or something like that, you don't take that to be as serious as getting something on their letterhead. It doesn't mean the same thing.
For example, they send out a student to Harvard Law, and their email address short enough says a lot of Harvard Law.
It doesn't have the same institutional meaning as
Well, in a way, this is highlighting a confusion, a kind of cultural confusion about the name that is reminiscent of the domain name domains. You know, it doesn't mean if you go to McDonald's.com that you will find authoritatively the Golden Arches, or is it going to be possibly something else? And of course, there's a feedback loop that answers the question. To the extent that people release the use of their name or their marks, one can more rely on it being the real thing. And to the extent that people aren't policing it, people might get into the habit ultimately of not taking it to be authoritative in that source. The other thing is, again, the absence. We're still in this absence of ubiquitous digital signature technology, so that if somebody just says something coming from HeraldWar.com and says, by the way, HeraldWar has a policy that says blah, you might well think it's somebody in a credible position to speak to it. As digital signatures become a way of saying, and I really am speaking on behalf of the firm, I'm really the firm's imprimatur as I say this, in the absence of it, you give it corresponding to those credence. So, yeah.
I promise I won't speak again, but I actually have the answer to the letterhead law question, so
just put it out there. Did you look it up or you just did it?
9 years ago, and I got fired because of this email thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, presumably it hasn't changed in 9 years, the answer is that the company doesn't have a right to look at the letter. They may have a claim for theft of property if you abuse their letterhead, but that would be the extent of their claim. Actually, as far as the courts have dealt with cases like that, the expectation of privacy in U.S. mail, happens the moment the letter is.
Yeah, from this Pentagon Papers case, for which the original claim of the Pentagon Papers to steal these national security secrets as they got put in the New York Times was the theft of the blank piece of paper to lend to the Xerox machine to make the copies for the New York Times. Yeah, behind you. Yeah, go ahead. Tell you.
What if the metaphor isn't about a sealed envelope, is it instead of postcard? And that's the thing, the question of this email. Has it been sealed and sort of sent privately, the expectation of privacy, or is it more like a postcard where it's printed and it's out there, someone's read it, you intended it to be private, they read it in the mailroom, maybe they shouldn't have read it, but it was right there for them to read anyway, and then take action.
Yeah, this sort of sounds like our FBI agent's description of the old style party lines. You used to have a phone that was actually hooked up to three other people and you share a line, just extensions of it from one house to another, and you would call an operator and say, please connect me to so-and-so. You didn't expect that to be a private act. And similarly, somebody might say, realize that when you hit send, it's actually getting forwarded to our operations supervisor who will take a look at it and send it on. And surely, the remnants of that stick around. If somebody sent something to you at T. Milgram, G-R-I-M, at law.harvard.edu, it would bounce back to them. A copy would be sent to Postmaster at law.harvard.edu. A man named Tom Kilday, very nice guy, in the basement of Hauser, would see the note and say, oh, that's for Talia. And actually, maybe, if he's feeling generous, forward it along to you after getting an idea from the note that was, in fact, intended for you. So there are instances in which it still retains some of that, you know, maybe on the other end of the line, helping answer your call. I'm told we have actually a remote comment from Hank. What's the employer's responsibility to inform its employees that surveillance of the email notification is taking place? Is there any reason why the patient privacy work environment even notice this thing is posted? Doctrinally, there doesn't appear to be a whole lot. Again, putting aside the special case of telephone communication, the email and web usage, it doesn't appear as if there is any duty to say whether or not you're watching, because it's your object and you're just allowing somebody to use it and you reserve all rights to yourself. One could imagine framing legislation on this topic. Again, California's legislation was vetoed by the governor, suggested something just like this, which would be short of simply banning the practice, would just say you have to conform, and maybe even thereby create a better market for people in the employment market deciding whether to go with an employer or monitors. But as just a doctrinal answer, it doesn't appear right now that there's really any obligation to enforce. Yeah, back.
This was what I was going to say as well. I think it all has to do with your expectation of privacy, just as you don't expect a postcard to be as private as a sealed letter. I think you should have the expectation, but maybe not given your doctrinal analysis, just given us that email is private unless you're given notice that it's being monitored.
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed there was a diminished expectation.
Yeah. Of course, reasonable, it's always reasonable expectation of privacy and Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, which we're sort of borrowing now, government surveillance. That too is something that this weird feedback loop, where what your reasonable expectation of privacy is may depend on how penetrable and how routine the penetration is in your communications are subjected to. And we can't determine that when we have brand new technology just sinking in. And interestingly, in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, reasonable expectation of privacy is typically decided by an introspective judge. Judge stares at Mabel, thinks, and then says, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in the glove compartment of the motor vehicle. However, the back of the taxi cab, you know, leaves. Of course you expect privacy there. Yeah.
There's also a lot of
leading
questions. Like,
say again.
It has a lot to do also with the meaning of the message. I think they're talking about the letter for the most part. You just get an email, especially cyber security, is so much easier for email to be duplicated, to be sent on, to be posted to a message board. And with all better things in the physical world, there is no real analogy. And so the company should have a greater right to monitor these emails from the company with its email address attached.
It does seem that you might advise somebody to send me nasty emails around. Be careful, that can end up in anyone's hands. Don't expect it to stay private. And as a result, give legal license to the firm under the application privacy standard to go ahead and take a look at it. Again, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah?
So, with cell phones, how does that work then? Do they have to inform you to speak about saying cell phones and marketing exceptions?
Yeah. It's a complicated doctrinal thing. The general my knowledge, yes. You've got to the employee, by the way, we, you know, are monitoring the call. You may even on the calls have to say, for this particular call, you know, here's a beep tone to tell you being monitored, right?
Yeah, I just don't understand why that's not true with email. I mean, I guess I would start from a different point than some people, but I have no reason to believe that somebody should be able to monitor any of my email until they experience. I mean, for example, in the thing that you pointed out, the hypo. It's one of the proof. When you're talking about the stock price being manipulated because of the board, that I believe the company has an interest in. But other than that, especially, I mean, the same thing maybe thinking about 2 years from now, I'm going to be spending my entire life in my office. I don't want to have to switch over to a
restaurant. Yeah, some of them have cocktail, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, basically, are they allowed to video tape me? Is that an expectation of privacy? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the infrared cameras and stuff really get you. do you have an answer for her? I mean, so you do have an answer right here, but it doesn't hurt.
Yeah, I would agree with people who are looking at this from the corporate governance point of view. I mean, I think that it all comes down to you are choosing to make a contract, employer-employee relationship in which you agree to give up some of your constitutional rights in this context. And if you don't like it, you're free to terminate your end of the contract. You stay, have rights to fire you if you don't uphold certain things, like if you don't work or if you start trashing the company. And I think that just as if you were to, at some point, if a friend visited you in your office, and as you're walking out of the elevator and asked, have you liked the place, you say, you know, I think it's terrible, you don't have any expectation that someone can't overhear you and then come back to you. Just as if you were in a bar somewhere on a Saturday night, you said the same thing. If there was someone else who worked at the company and happened to overhear you, you know, you're not necessarily guaranteed an immunity for that. So I think that.
But you'd feel a little differently if the bartender were, in fact, a company employee. It was just a nearby neighborhood bar, and the company found it worth their while to retain the bartender before everything got said.
No, that wouldn't change my opinion. I mean, I think that a lot of this has to
do with. What if we get with the bartender says, tell me more? How interesting.
As he was giving me drinks.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, how clearly has the employer stated their expectation. But if they have the expectation in the contract that, you know, you're not going to speak ill of the company, otherwise we terminate your contract, that's, you know, you're choosing to spend, if you choose to give up that much of your free time such that you don't have the free time to, you know, talk to your friends about this, then, you know, that's the work environment that you've chosen. But you can also just choose to terminate that contract and establish a film with someone that gives you more free time.
But when they sign employment contracts, are in a completely different bargaining position than a company. They're going to bargain away their privacy rights because they need a job. People don't graduate from here and aren't lucky enough to do that. Well, definitely, but we'll bargain away that right. I don't know. I think that the market, I would definitely not be this the market. You were talking, right, you were writing about how there is no organized protection for privacy.
So I guess we just have a species of the genus of argument over whether the bump market can take care of problem X, or whether in fact we ought to establish certain floors of ceilings, either because certain individuals are in a bad bargaining position and we just don't want them abused, which is fundamental rights to worry about, or there is a worry that the collective action of each of these multiple employment agreements will lead to a whole that is simply socially undesirable. That at least was the argument, and one of the arguments we understood from the intellectual property technological protection schemes, which as they get invented doesn't mean a company has to use them. They can still give their stuff away, but one might find the market evolving in a way that locks stuff up tight. Consumers happily accept such an arrangement to pay by the song, but somehow maybe collectively we would say that leads to a speech situation that is impoverishing to all of us. But again, there's a whole lot of things that have to be demonstrated before that seems to be coming. Argument. I think this may be the last one. The title is competitive by kind of situation. The firm responded appropriately. After all, the message anyway, the lawyers in the firm, notably those in leadership positions, and the explicit recommendation to not seek employment, a direct consequence of the law firm as a service provider seeking to. You could imagine this is harkening back kind of to Adler's piece from a couple weeks ago about the net-wide search with the law firm. You can see actually scanning the emails for a certain profile. Only show me emails that are trashing the firm. And if we have software that is decent enough, it looks for, you know, I mean, my Eudora 5.0 now assigns a certain number of chili peppers to a message when I get it. And apparently the more chili peppers there are, the more inflammatory the message is. So far, they appear to bear no relationship at all with the content of the message. But I have a free version. So you can imagine at least a way of searching the stuff, not reading it. Only human eyes only see the email if, in fact, it seems that the email is engaging in a behavior that itself is not acceptable at the firm. And indeed, this is the same official point. There's one more that I wanted to just find, but somehow it must have vanished. Oh well. Anyway, any other closing comments before we jump on to the next chunk? Yeah, Doug.
Just out of curiosity, I'm wondering if anybody was able to argue for monitoring the airwaves in a sci-fi scenario.
I don't know if I can use the buttons to get back to it anymore. Oh yeah, there it is. This is possible now. We have to be able to follow. The firm should still have the rights to monitor the airwaves because it's essentially their air. As long as they inform the employee of this monitoring method, and then they can't read it because there's anything there. Saying they do not have the right to monitor some things like saying they can't monitor the light waves or the sound waves that are in the office. It's all spectrum, isn't it? It's just EM spectrum. It's just a difference of degree. 5300 Kelvin is the same as, you know, 2300 on a spectroscopic scale. Somebody was able to argue with Doug, and Jeff did.
I was just wondering if there's any way to say something along the lines of, I mean, obviously you can't monitor cellular phone conversations that happen in the past 3 years, you know, the fact that it originated in the office, within the office walls, you know, is there anything that says that the company has the ability to monitor any signals that originate from within the company's property, much like you might try to regulate a radio station or something along those lines, you know, where it's transmitting from within the office boundaries?
I don't know if that would pass muster on the specific, again, sui generis protection against eavesdropping on cell transmissions, as Simpson so contemptuously put it. You know, there are parts of the spectrum that I'm not allowed to listen to anymore. You got the sense of, like, you know, what if, you know, the search for extraterrestrial buildings had something going there? Simpson couldn't find it. It is, though, I mean, all of this is an astounding invocation of a physical-based notion of property in order to justify a particular relationship vis-a-vis your employees. I own the server. You say, well, I'm not using your server, I'm using Yahoo, but I own the wires. Well, I'm not using your wires, I'm using wireless. Yes, but it's passing through my air. And I own the EM spectrum within my building. It's not clear, though, because after all, 100.7 is broadcasting to each of us right now because I'm having the appropriate affiliates or more.
I was wondering whether or not the provision of computers for the motor company by each of the employees with a computer at home, I'm sorry, is providing each of its employees with a home computer. And I'm wondering if they're going to extend the sort of their corporate internet into the homes and whether or not they're going to monitor communications that way. If that's part of the extension, I'm asking.
I mean, certainly, that's a good question, right? You end up taking a company laptop home and using it for your personal stuff. I don't know.
Not laptop. I'm just talking about, like, some companies are providing home computing for all their employees.
Oh, actually, this is like a friendly thing to do. I don't know. I mean, it's unclear if they were to give your kids vouchers to go to private school, if they can then, you know, own all the information your kid learned. I wouldn't put it past them necessarily, but it would be a difficult question. But again, people would say try to apply additional contract theories to it. And of course, that depends on what you're paying for. What was the starting point? What were the entitlements before contract may have tried to push them to private law in one direction or another? So let me try to just kind of pull this together a little bit. As we talk about what do we want to do about such things, if in fact we're inclined to do something about it, here are a few models for privacy regulations we've seen repeated both yesterday and even now. One is the arms race model, and that's John Verity's sort of model that says, he's all in favor of it because he knows how to arm himself, whereby, if you don't like it, just, you know, get stronger encryption, or use the Yahoo means, really. You know, if you subject yourself in a way to being monitored, so long as there's an easy alternative not to be monitored, you have only yourself to blame. And even Paul Levy was unwilling to say anything negative about Terry Lunsner's what we call contextualizations, right? Terry Lunsner goes on and pretends to be somebody else in service of to a client who's trying to track down somebody they're about to sue for millions of dollars. And Paul says, hey, all's fair, you know? I can't help it if my client is stupid and divulges his identity because somebody lies, pretexts to him. You know, that's just the way it goes. So that is one way of having the arms race of just brains. There's also the arms race of the technology and what tech is there, conditions surveil, and what isn't. And of course, as you know, we saw Lessig, right, either in the Xerox pirate version or the Hadoop version, Lessig is a little bit nervous that you know the arms race can drastically lower the costs of monitoring. He was basically writing comments of government surveillance, the same thing with corporate surveillance. Such that what previously had been de facto private, because it was just too much effort to monitor, is simply no longer so. And our tried and true detente, our baseline, then gets shifted around. And if you tune into my theory of so-called Janus technologies, what could be true one day, oh God, we're in the Orwellian Big Brother state, and the next day, once we get the right strong encryption attached to Bjorn 5.1, suddenly nobody can monitor anything. And you end up with, say, a hostile work environment in which somebody in the office is getting harassing anonymous emails from somebody else clearly in the office, somebody who's watching this employee making comments about her, and you can't trace it back. And now suddenly, you're worried about, one, facing a lawsuit for creating a hostile work environment by allowing email you have to figure out how to surveil. And secondly, as an ethical matter, you're worried that, you know, you want to help this person and somebody's engaging in bad conduct and you can't find out who they are. And both of those scenarios, either the Orwellian one or the total anarchy one, are the function of whether or not somebody manages to install the right software somewhere. So that's sort of the arms race theory. The second is what we've been talking about, is kind of contract theory. That's the straws we grasp at to solve this problem without having to get into complicated statutes. Right, we say, well, if we can just get them to shake hands on some scheme, any scheme, that's the scheme. And there are some exceptions in our thinking to that, such as your point, well, right, we have a bargaining position, so we don't want to simply validate any contract the parties can come with. But certainly the recurring tool here is if you can get a certain agreement going, and even Bruce Keller was talking a lot yesterday about people will shop for internet service providers, he's fairly confident, on the basis of how that internet service provider says it will react to a subpoena. Now, it's not clear to me that people will typically do that. Maybe somebody who is planning to back out the company will inspect carefully which ISP he or she is using. The person who makes a casual comment and says this firm sucks while using their AT&T, you know, Media One home account may not have decided between that and DSL on the basis of how each one
respond to a subpoena served to it in the context of the lawsuit. But we saw some agreement among the panel at exactly that point, that contract is yet another way then in the relationship between the ISP and the consumer to solve the subpoena problem. If it's dumb enough to sign up with an ISP that says, hey, anybody calls up and asks about you, we're going to tell them. That's sort of your own problem. In addition to that, we have various forms of regulation. And those could be the European Union's directive on data privacy, what had been the Privacy Act of 74 here in the United States, coming out of the Nixonian era. There was some concern about privacy. And the original iterations of the Privacy Act, which covered all sorts of computer databases, people were worried about computer databases then, said, you know, you're not allowed to part with information in this database without the following things being true, including consent to the person from whom the information was derived. And as it works its way to the committee, the private database part of it got stripped. So the Privacy Act exists. It only governs government databases, though, in the United States, not private databases of information. And within those sorts of regulatory things, you can have regulation on the collection end. This is the kind of data you are allowed to collect. And once the conditions on which it's collected are no longer met, you must destroy it. The European directive has a wonderful provision on having to expunge and destroy old data once it's no longer useful for the original purpose for which it's collected. You might say that the use is somehow prohibited. You're allowed to snoop on your employees. You can learn certain facts about them, but you may not fire an employee on the basis of, you know, X, Y, or Z. If the employee was making certain statements about union organizing, trying to assert that employee's right to organize, you are in big trouble if you fire that employee as a result. That's an example of prescription on the use of certain information, rather than it shall be illegal to collect any information from an employee that has to do with organizing if you are at the water cooler or the bar and listening to what that employee does. Of course, as you might guess, those are quite difficult things to prove. Sometimes when you're fired, it's just because times are tight, rather than because of that thing you said, I'm not allowed to fire you, upon you're fired. And of course, the third has to do with dissemination. You might think that's a category of use, but it's not just using it for your own purposes, but further alienating the data on other people. And as we shift away from kind of workplace monitoring and into more general marketing of personal data for commercial purposes, dissemination turns out to be one of the things that is most worried about. The Fair Credit Reporting Act is a good example of an act that worries most about dissemination, a little less on collection, and somewhat on use. People tend to agree that the Fair Credit Reporting Act is a monstrosity of law that no one understands if you were into. But doesn't mean that regulation itself is somehow indicted. So those are sort of the models, as I see them, to kind of give them a good run-through, even in our current hypotheticals. I just wanted to bracket this. So this is a product called NetSeed. Maybe you can jump over to birchstreetsys.com. You can't really tell from the picture, but in past iterations of this class, I've actually had Jim Gavel, the CEO of Birchstreet Systems, come to visit. He's a wonderful guy. He has devised a program in his company, which is a local company sales, which you simply download, or even download the demo of the site. I encourage you not to do that here, John. But what this thing will do is, in a corporate LAN, you can simply install it on each client and on a server. And the server can be wherever. It can be, say, in the dean's office. And then clients can be in the computer lab. And with that, the dean can press a button and get a Brady Bunch-style screen divided into four sections and just see four screens at a time. And just watch whatever is on the screens of the client's computers at that instant. Or ask it to take a snapshot every 3 minutes of a given computer screen and then review the sequence of snapshots. He calls it a productivity monitoring tool. And there's some wonderful, maybe I'll find a way to forward it to you, some wonderful ads he's designed, you know, with the kind of softcore porn and saying, you know what your employees are doing with your equipment, you know, you should. And then cites a raft of statistics saying that pretty much all of corporate America just looks at porn all day. And here's a way to run our software so you can look at it too. And then fire the relevant people who are looking at it. So, and you talk to him about it, you say, well, isn't this Big Brother? He gets this big gap-toothed grin, and he says, of course it is.
he says he provides stairs. And all of his clients, he encourages them to take the stickers, which say, warning, your computer is being watched, and stick them upon their employees' computers all around. He says he doesn't actually audit to see whether they use the stickers that he gives them. He just installs the software and lets it run. This stuff, from what I can tell, if you try to corner him on how prevalent it is, he's very caged. He doesn't like to involve, he's sensitive about his privacy, doesn't like to involve his client list, but he does admit that business is booming, and that most of the Fortune 500 have at one time or another contacted him when his competitors are shopping to install such software and to be able to use it on their machine. And he, of course, is again the first among many to say, you may well have a corporate obligation to use this stuff precisely because of the worries about hostile work environments. You need to know what your employees are up to, or at least you can compile a database so that if something hits the fan later on, you can go back and act accordingly. So, let me jump back to the right. Yeah, there it is. Oops, we both clicked. So, all right, so having rearranged things then, we have identity as one part of the bubble, I put speech, actions, and transactions as three things in which if you are an orange dot, you're doing these things all the time online. You have a certain identity, you're engaged in speech, you're doing certain other acts online, maybe it's gambling, maybe it's something else, and of course, transactions as well. Corporate things. And with this, just as a point about identity itself is not an atomic concept. I worry that we've been thinking of it too much as what's your name or what's not your name, and that's your identity. This is Department of Public Safety from the state of Alabama. Maybe you can jump to gsiweb.net, www.gsiweb.net. This is up on the web for your viewing pleasure. And this is anybody who's been convicted of a sex offense in the state of Alabama. And to be sure, these are public records, of course. You could go to the courthouse, I don't know how many people have, probably very few, and look up such records, but now it's online. Are you, oh yeah, there's not that work. Yeah, gsiweb.com, I think it was. What was it at? That's.com. There it is. Okay, so click on sex offenders. And then go ahead and just do a county search. We'll look at Talbot County. And then Alyssa Banks, you're going to want to just go to one of these fellows. So there he is, Roger Raymond Brown. There's his description. There's the crime information. And if you scroll down on the screen a little bit, on the right, you can click to view a map of Jeremy Falsera's approximate location. And it pulls out Winamp, but also, I don't know, that's a terabyte screen to the victim, but there is County Highway 20 West with a red X marks the spot. It's exactly where you want to drop the bomb if you're looking to make him pay for what he did. And there it is on that map. You can find out exactly where the guy lives. Now, this is all a tangent to establish that Jeremy Paul Sterrett, part of his identity is as a sex offender. That's part of who he is. When he walks around the street, right, we're thinking Solveig Singleton here, you know certain things about him. You know that he looks like that. Maybe you make judgments about him on the basis of it. However, typically, you would not make judgments about him on the basis of his being a sex offender because you'd have no reason to know. You just wouldn't know it. And if you wrote a letter to the editor from the paper on some particular topic, you know, the way this tax increase or something, you wouldn't know. Now, with the ability to just punch in his name and click it up, his identity is far more tied. This element of his identity as a sex offender is kind of carried around. It is a form of, I don't want to say scarlet letter, but it's a form of who he is that will be tracking him where he goes so long as he's using his name, et cetera, et cetera. Again, as the era of digital signatures comes upon us, there's only one valid name he can offer in a transaction that says, this is who I am. And oh yeah, here's the flyer, if you can print out, give to your friends. He was released, reason, and consent. With this we see that the nature of identity is quickly changing as a result of many of these databases. Now there are databases that are conceptually identical to this one for the purpose of associating us with a certain identity. You remember Ben, who I'm here lately. But Ben
is somebody who's very smart. He shops. He uses coupons all the time. He's the nightmare shopper for a merchant because he always buys the loss leader and then leaves. Or he'll cash in 10 coupons, he laboriously collected, and get $15 off a $10 product, and then get $5 and the product. So he went to Mercado.com, a commerce site, went to buy some things, put in his credit card number, and was told, sorry, your credit card number didn't parse. And he knew the card was working, he called customer service and asked. Customer service said, no, no, we just choose not to do business with you. I said, what do you mean? He said, we know about you. We share information, basically have a sex offender registry for people who are smart shoppers, and we just assume you're not shop here, right? We have a contract, we choose not to enter into a contractual relationship with you. And Ben had to forge a different name in order to buy his products from Mercado, that's four. That is a preview of next Monday's class, where we'll be talking about this practice, basically called weblining, and so-called price discrimination, by which not only can you serve like your customers, who you like and who you don't, but how fat their wallets respectively are and how much you charge to each one. I'm trying to wait until I have two economists here to actually figure out whether we should believe this is a good thing or a bad thing. Okay, so that was all just about my identity there. And as we saw from Blessing, there is a sense in which you can be monitoring this stuff. And of course, as technology evolves over time, your ability to monitor is changing in one direction or another. And the sense in which it's all pouring into large toxic vats we call databases that at some point could be searched. And we have that monitor of the search. And as we do this stuff, there are varying degrees of surveillance able to take place upon us. So that sort of shifts us into commercial privacy. And when we're talking about commercial privacy, we're talking first off about privacy between consumer and merchant. Just like the model we were using between employee and employer, we're wondering about what are the rules as I go to Amazon.com or Buy.com, and between me and them, we come to an understanding of some sort about what they can do with the data gathered on me that I tend to like these particular kinds of movies and these particular kinds of books. What can they do with that information? The panel for today prepared a case study that bears somewhat on this. Does anybody from the panel want to kind of get us into that a little bit? Who's on the panel today? Oh, I'm sorry. Great. So I don't know who wants to take the lead of money, but yeah, go for it.
We wrote about Amazon specifically because they did something not only highly related to what ToySmart did in the reading, but a lot of people would just assume they did based on what ToySmart did, which was they changed their privacy policy. And ToySmart kind of got caught with their hands in the jar because they didn't change their privacy policy. They went to bankruptcy, and then they tried to do something that was in opposition to what their privacy policy said.
What was the something they tried to do?
Well, their privacy policy said we will never share customer list, customer data with any third party. And then when they went to bankruptcy, pretty much their only asset in bankruptcy was their customer list.
Yeah.
They advertised in the Wall Street Journal saying who wants to buy it. And I think trustee clipped that first, and then the FTC took it up and took it to court for it.
And what was the result?
They settled. The FTC probably would not have been able to nail them. That's kind of hard to tell. There's not really much case law on this.
Yeah.
Whether or not a customer list is really an asset in bankruptcy that you can really sell. It's an unfair practice with consumers because your privacy policy said never. And now you want to resell it to a third party.
So one quick thing to realize, and we're talking about the Federal Trade Commission, for which there are often companion commissions at the state level. And the Federal Trade Commission is empowered, this is kind of just a roving commission, empowered to seek out and identify unfair or deceptive trade practices and stop them from happening. And if it finds an unfair or deceptive trade practice, it can send a nasty letter, it can send a second nasty letter, then it can eventually assess penalties of various kinds that then get reviewed by courts. But it through this kind of common law process of sending nasty letters, Federal Trade Commission tries to identify certain practices that are unfair or deceptive. Often, buying a product and then, as Bruce was complaining, getting an empty box from WorldwideScam.com. He didn't get what he ordered, he was shocked and confused. That would be something for which he could refer it to the FTC, which would probably say, we don't have enough lawyers for this, but thank you for the information. We they get more than 1,500 complaints on the subject, we'll send them a letter and take it from there. So they got a bunch of complaints and pressure from TrustE and some other .org-like groups and asserted, no, ToySpark, you promised in your privacy policy not to do this, and now you are putting it on the block. And what was the settlement again? What was the outcome of it?
Basically, they agreed that they can't sell, ToySpark will not sell its customer list unless it's in conjunction with the sale of the entire website to a similar site that's, I forget if it's like family or child or, you know, entertainment product member oriented.
Right.
And you buy the entire site, the whole kit, and if that doesn't happen within like a year and a half, then they agree to destroy all the data.
Right. And that may be perfectly consonant with the privacy policy, because at that point it may not be a third party, but simply a successor heir in interest to the liabilities and privileges of the first party, which is ToySpark. Okay, so that was ToySpark. So what did Amazon do?
Amazon, probably in response to that, the debacle that ToySpark had to go through, has adapted their privacy policy, which before basically said, no, we'll never do that. And now I think basically says, no, we'll never do that, but we reserve the right to change our minds in the future.
Yes, this is sort of a piece of meta contracting, right? And this is the primary way we've seen regulation of corporate use of data collected transactionally in the United States has been. There they are. I mean, there's a privacy notice.
Word never.
It says no word never. You can state a privacy policy, and then you better come to it. If you say you're going to do one thing, you do another, the FTC might come after you for having engaged in unfair deceptive trade practice. But if you have a meta statement in the policy that says, by the way, we reserve the right to change our policy, then, of course, the contract says, this is what we'll do until we don't. And that's the nature of the contract. So is that what you've got that Amazon is saying right now?
There hasn't been. There's no resolution. There aren't, to the best of my knowledge, there's not. There aren't any lawsuits pending. I mean, they're definitely saying it's well within their right, because they haven't been caught on their hand in the cookie jar. I mean, the issue is really, is there fair notice? I mean, you know, when I became a customer on Amazon for the first time, I don't even remember if they presented me with the with their privacy policy.
Had they done so, do you think you would have read it?
Probably not.
So this is one issue with the contract model of the handling of private data. There is a classic kind of contract that you should have gave us a rental car policy where you just want a damn car. You know, you're not there to figure out where if you go off the road at 70 miles an hour, how big is your deductible for the most part. On the other hand, of course, if the thing is published and if it is the same to all comers, then you can have somebody, right? Paul Levy, who has spare time, is on behalf of all of us. He'll look at that thing with a magnifying glass and raise a ruckus, or trust me, or you know, something like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and maybe they could make a big deal, and thus you would believe that so long as the policies have to be published and consistent from one person to the next, and they are forced to use the policy, maybe we'll end up with consumer-friendly policies because of these proxies who might be on our behalf. It also may be worthwhile to note, Larry, towards the end of his piece on this, mentions P3P, the Platform for Privacy Preferences. The idea behind which was, you could tell your browser a whole bunch of stuff about yourself and say, I'm going to fill out a form once and for all that says, these are the conditions by which I will release such information. And then as I go and encounter websites on the web, that website will have a way of talking to my browser and telling it what its conditions are. This is what we do with information. But what they say they do with it goes beyond what I told my browser I wanted sites like that to do with it. No dice, no agreement is made. This is so-called agent contracting. My own browser is my agent to negotiate the contract. Some people have been very excited about it. Basically, Zip has happened so far implementing it. And, of course, there are reasons to feel skeptical about it, too. Are there any other elements of your case study you want to set up right now before we keep rolling? So this is a good example of something that Amazon may even do. Somehow, when Amazon changed its policy, it was a slow news day, got a blip, the New York Times ran something, and then the following week it was essentially forgotten. I was amazed. I've talked to some people. In fact, I talked to HLS Brad, joined somebody, I forget the last name, who was the CEO of Amazon. Very nice woman. And, you know, I said, yeah, what about this privacy thing? She was not that impressed with privacy as an issue. And those ask letters from federal trade commission, that's what you have lawyers for. You hire them, they work it, eventually it goes away. And surely there is a kind of, schism in our own thinking about it. As to, we feel often privacy is a hot button issue, but then we of course act in a way that doesn't seem to safeguard it very much. Why don't we jump back to the slides? So let's see, I'm starting here. So we have consumer merchants, and then between consumer and merchants partners. See, it's not just what junk mail are you going to get from Amazon when Amazon starts collecting your stuff and starts especially targeting you for Jim Carrey movies because you seem to have an affinity for Dumb and Dumber. And then before you know it, wherever you go on Amazon, it's like, no, really, don't you want the latest Jim Carrey movie? There's also the idea that the merchant may have partners. Drugstore.com. Don't you need some Tylenol after watching the Jim Carrey movies you've been watching? Or barely you have kids who are renting Dumb and Dumber. Don't you want some diapers? And there's also a sense in which the very web technology enables a whole complex set of arrangements between Amazon and others, because one way in which a site makes money, and maybe just jump to www.buy.com, and then people have used buy.com, the internet superstore. Use it before it goes out of business. www.buy.com. Buy.com, from what anybody external reading their books can tell, loses money on every single thing you purchase. Not a lot of money, like just a little bit, like a dime. But the more you buy, the more they lose. And their business model appears to be, for one thing, making sure they have the lowest price on pretty much anything, since after all, they can't make a profit. But while you shop, they show you ads. And they're hoping that you'll shop for a long time, that the money they make on the ads they show you while you're shopping more than makes up, should you do the precipitous steps of actually buying something, than what they lose when you finally buy something. Now, the way a web page gets rendered, you can have, as the page is getting thrown together, there's an ad for the X-Files. You can actually have buy say, I'm going to auction off that piece of the page, and I'm going to have some third party, call it double click, provide the ad that goes there. And I don't even know what that page is going to look like to the consumer, because double click, at the last minute, can decide what ad goes up onto that site. And indeed, double click doesn't sell anything to consumers. You go to their site, it's not really a site that sells you anything. However, you are probably interacting a lot with DoubleClick wherever you go, because the ads are being provided by DoubleClick as kind of a market maker in advertising. What does DoubleClick get out of it? Well, they in turn place the ads with people. So if somebody wants to advertise something, they can go to DoubleClick, and DoubleClick can say, well, what kind of people do you want to see this ad? Well, it's for dog food, preferably dog lovers. And DoubleClick says, that's great, because we've been collecting some information from places like buy.com. They tell us about who's buying what. At the moment we place an ad on a buy.com customer screen, we also assign them a number so that when they go to another site served by DoubleClick, we'll remember that that was the person we met over at Buy. And indeed, as more pages get drawn up, we'll get a sense through their click stream of what they're ordering. And then we can proceed to gather a whole profile. We can know something about their identity in the sense of what they like and what they don't, even if we don't yet know their name, and we could market stuff to them accordingly. So it's a fairly complicated set of transactions that technology is enabled that goes on, for which a privacy policy may or may not speak to it. Now, I don't know if anybody has a view right now, coming off of our discussion about corporate workplace privacy, as to what the baseline should be. Suppose the company is either silent, it has no privacy policy, so maybe what should the background rule be? Or has a one-line privacy policy that says take your chances. Order stuff, we won't sell your customer information, we reserve the right to build a profile on you and target ads accordingly. And in that instance, is there anybody to say that that is actually a problem? So I don't know, is there anybody who feels differently from one to the other? Anybody who's in favor of some rule about workplace privacy who just doesn't see the nightmare here? Or vice versa, yeah, Allison.
Well, I don't know. Where is the workplace privacy? I believe the kind kind of a visceral reaction. Like, I really didn't want my things monitored. I was kind of convinced by the article, at least persuaded someone we read about, you know, free speech rights inherent in you communicating with a business, and then why should they not be able to communicate that information whenever they want? And it feels wrong a little bit to me, but I really don't know what could combat that argument.
Yeah, there's a Solvay's article. And indeed, it does introduce that the relationship between speech and privacy isn't just if your anonymity is protected, you're more willing to speak. But if you are asserting your privacy, after all, what is that but an assertion, if it's not on collection, but on dissemination, about what others may say, which in turn has speech implications? Is there anybody that feels concerned enough about privacy in this particular corporate realm to give us a gripping nightmare scenario? What's the worst case here? Is it really just about being sold Austin Powers movies when I'm found to be an Austin Powers fan, or dog food? Is that the nightmare here? What's the worst case? Yeah, go ahead.
I think the worst case is the e-merchant, has figured out exactly what you're willing to pay where, and you, as a law professor, are identified as someone who will pay a premium for books online, and then everything that you can get from any channel, you have an extraordinary premium you have to pay, which is different from what everyone else has to pay. So you have this wonderful database of all your interests. So your price, so they're able to perfectly match your price to what their price is. So all of your consumer surplus is gone, and there's just a nightmare across the whole internet. What everybody wants to pay a lot more for.
So consider this nightmare properly lodged, and will be relived as a night terror on Monday when we talk about the web line price information, and both about how likely it is that this could come about market-wise, and if it does come about, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Another nightmare.
I think that the idea has a good potential. It looks like it's economically efficient, but the nightmare is, who's building the code? What does the code implement? Are the consumers involved in building the code?
But what's the worst thing the code can do to us?
Exactly. Discriminate between consumers, give their information away to people they don't know. For example, this privacy policy that says at any given time we can just change our policy. I don't think that this should be legally binding.
So I'm still looking for something concrete. I want to be scared. Yeah, scare me.
I think I saw a TV show once. I'm like, I have no reference for this.
I'm scared already.
Someone was being stalked because somebody had gotten hold of their, when you click stuff at the grocery store and then you push a little card through Star Market that gives you a discount. That people were tracking what they were buying.
Yeah, the old Star Market Advantage card, right?
Exactly.
I was smart. I registered in the name of my ex-girlfriend's cat. But anyway, yes, go ahead.
Somehow, somebody puts this all together. They figure out who you are, where you live, all your preferences, and then you have the potential for being cyber-stalked or stalked.
So that seems a pretty scary nightmare. And it entails having to jump from the cozy world of Solvay Citizen, where mom and pops are just trying to break into the market for a given product, and they just want to use this to sell you stuff. That's not a form of stalking. That's just a form of consumerism. So somehow, if this information were tied back to you and profitable to somebody really going after you, not to sell you things, but to stalk you or learn things about you, whether an employer looking to learn more about you and want you to score during the interview, or an insurance company wanting to see if you had said a false thing about whether a given condition was pre-existing, could they pay drcoop.com to see whether you had filled out a questionnaire about back pain long before you said it happened? There are certain individual abuses that maybe we could identify that might raise the hackles of those of us worried about such things. Any other scenario? Yeah, TJ.
I guess to take that a notch farther, I think the business options is sound business practice. That's where I get it. But not just a stalker, like you brought up, the insurance company, the government. When they're able to make this not just purchase profile, but in many instances when it's based on the sites you visit, this emotional profile, you are, seriously, I know this term's getting thrown around, you're seriously pushing this big brother realm where they can psychologically manipulate you, almost like maybe like a Clockwork Orange type thing. Where you're able to know exactly what triggers a person, what books they like to read, types of things they like to see. As you say, with Dr. Cooper, WebMD, potentially their medical condition, to see what they're researching on. And when you start profiling all this information, and this isn't just...
Isn't that just called know your customer?
Pardon?
What if
it's not your customer? What if it is the government? What if it is an employer? What if it is somebody, or not somebody, but some organization, terrorist, whatever type of organization, who wants to manipulate you and brainwash you or whatever, just get you into their organization, and they can really pull at these emotional strings or these physiological strings and to get at you. That's where I see it being a nightmare.
Well, your question about the nightmare scale, you definitely edged on it. I don't know if you sold the screenplay rights yet. And then, of course, we start saying, why, is this really plausible? And we have the evidence that this is taking place, which is a decent question, and one for which asking some of the Simpsons of the world, right, off of Database Nation. Simpson is right with you. Simpson says, oh yeah, this is right around the corner. And then talk to others and say, is this likely to have a market coalesce around it? I think we're running low on time, although that clock is massively too far ahead, so we're going by that. So I'm going to probably agree. Here's a comment coming up. I feel like cash-based bargaining power is being handed about too quickly. Seems as applicable as arguments, consumers have no bargaining powers against grocery stores and set the price of milk. Of course, we all know the price of milk is set by the milk board in that case. So there's no bargaining at all. It's just set by whatever the board says it is. Competition of market, which are free to change or play, which has the stock gap on, like, say, the global sweatshop, which costs from place much higher. And arguably, that amount you're saying, same to go for privacy. People can choose, at least at the point of collection, whether or not they want to part with their information, and then maybe, even as it's collected, certain promises can be made against its use. Envy, we will not give this to, mind control organizations looking to control you, but rather to government companies. Yeah, Heather.
I think there needs to be a line drawn between identifying who someone is and letting them react to something. And remembering that the internet allows us to do a lot of cool things that we do for an internet car company. So one of the things we were doing was profiling what kind of cars people wanted. Right now, the cars are so many different options and configurations of cars, and it's not really efficient. It's not helping you. Because you get a car you don't want, you're charging more because you're having even cost of building your own cars, et cetera, et cetera. And by using the data, the manufacturer doesn't know who you are or anything else, but please tell them that they don't need to make climate cars in red, they should make them in blue. And hypothetically, all of that would make, in the end, it would make the situation better for the end buyer because they're going to get cars cheaper and they're going to get the cars they want.
The better you can know your customer, the fewer false starts you have and stuff. You won't get Edsel's anymore.
And hypothetically, it'll help you because you'll be buying the car cheaper because the manufacturers are going to manufacture them a lot more efficiently.
Yeah.
And I know that's the argument, but I think before we just throw it, the kind of things that everybody's saying, all user data is bad, and I agree. I'm wants to know that Heather Lindsay wants a white certain make and model of a car, but to the extent that the data can be used to make things more efficient, I don't want to debate about that necessarily.
Gotcha. We're running very well on time. Just give me one quick comment here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's balance between there are some consumers who are privacy sensitive and some who are price sensitive, and I think there's a systematic grouping of those two. People who are wealthy are privacy sensitive. People who are less wealthy, I think, are much more price sensitive.
So just let the market sort them out.
Well, no. I think if you have a model like the internet model has developed, where information, all kinds of information resources, are available for free because of invasions on privacy, like NewYorkTimes.com is free because it's able to gather a tremendous amount of information about the users, and it adds tremendous value to the ads that they place there.
Yes.
Some people prosper in a world where suddenly a great amount of resources are much cheaper or free because privacy is less important to them and price is more important to them. Whereas other people, price is less important, privacy is more important, and I think you'll find...
So what does this lead you to conclude? Is this having to say?
I think that there are regressive distribution effects to privacy. The more privacy you have, the more you're going to hurt poor people.
So this amounts... I see. So I'm sure this is not what you're necessarily going to say, but it's kind of like selling your organs. To the extent that we prohibit a market and organ selling from taking place, poor people who would rather have $50,000 and two kidneys are limited in their options.
Well, it's not just, it's I wouldn't make that.
Yeah, I figured you would.
But what's particularly happening is that the marketers are most interested in internet buyers. So if you're an internet information user, if you actually go use the internet to learn things and communicate with people, you're getting all kinds of services for free now, and you're being subsidized by people who have a lot of disposable income to buy stuff on Amazon.com and buying Jim Carrey movies so that you can read the New York Times.
So let me do what I can to just pack this together for the last minute we have. You saw our classic sort of chart of the internet. What we've been talking about, consumer to merchant or consumer to merchant's partners, was still basically you on one end of the net, the cloud in the middle, and the merchant on the other end. And data goes between the two of you, and then maybe the merchant further shares it away from the merchant's node. But there may be a way in which some of those intermediate ISPs could capture value. This is a very recent Cambridge company, started by people for whom the average age in this room is higher than those people. And it's called Predictive Networks. Catch the stream, release the potential. What does Predictive Networks do? Wonderful name. It sort of has a TJ Poignant nightmare effect of Predictive Networks. What are they predicting exactly? So here's what they're doing. They're saying, look, you're an internet service provider. You have a whole bunch of stuff coming from your customers going through your computers. Think back to workplace privacy. They're yours, right? You own them. And your customers are using them to ship data through you on its way to buy.com or newyorktimes.com or anywhere else. Now, it's one thing for buy.com to use that stuff, God bless them, but you're sitting on a gold mine, right? You've got all that clickstream data. And often, when you click to buy a computer or a particular model on buy, it creates a link, which is, please take me to buy.com/ThinkPad/570/cheapo. And then somebody watching that request could surmise if you were about to buy a particular kind of ThinkPad. So what Predictive Networks does is makes a deal with an ISP through which software is installed and quietly downloads to your machine. And as you use your ISP, each of your clicks, the data you are sending associated with that click, this is the kind of pen register data, not the content necessarily of your email, but what links you're clicking upon as you surf the web, that is getting reported to your ISP and then onward to Predictive Networks. And what does Predictive Networks do with it? They create what they call a digital silhouette. The digital silhouette is uniquely tied to your computer. They say, we don't care what your name is, we just need to know that you are you. You are the same computer that visited yesterday. And with this digital silhouette, we will come to judgments about how responsive you are to dog food, and how responsive you are to this and to that. Do you tend to be an empty nester, somebody who's probably had kids but does no longer, and now orders out of well-being catalogs because you've got nothing else to do. I mean, they have various categories of things. Each click you make contributes to the digital silhouette, and then the digital silhouette follows you around as you go and governs what advertising you may see, in addition to whatever's done with the data on the other end. This is the next wave of privacy-implicating technologies. Predictive Networks have been quite smart about it. They have hired an advisory board, including some prominent academics. They've given them tenure, which is to say 18-month terms, no matter how many disparaging things they choose to say about Predictive Networks. And have said they're going to make their technology open for the viewing. So I don't really have time to comment on it, except to say it's out there.